Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags with 30 minutes on South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast, interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, all in a concise and informative update. It's Thursday, the 25th of July. Coming up on our program, there is concern over the new Public Procurement Act, the risks of artificial intelligence in the practice of law, South Africa's new critical skills survey, and if you're in ICT or engineering, you are in the pound seat. How worried should we be about wasp invasions? Expat Web is the largest independent work permit and immigration provider in South Africa and overnight has released its annual critical skills survey, shedding light on the current state of skilled labour in this country. Now, as South Africa continues to navigate a complex economic landscape, these insights from the survey would be crucial for understanding the needs and the future strategies of employers in an increasingly competitive global market. Marissa Jacobs is the MD of Expat Web and joins me now. And Marissa, first of all, then, let's get some context here. What does the survey actually set out to do?
Yes. So the annual critical skills survey that we do is really feedback from large corporates and multinationals in South Africa asking the question, what skills do business find most difficult to recruit currently? Which are the skills that they, when they go out to market, they find it hard to find and they find themselves more often needing to expand their recruitment efforts internationally to be able to find those skills? And then based on that feedback, we are able to, in the survey, get down to a top 10 list of which are the most difficult skills to recruit in South Africa.
And we do love a list on this program, Marissa. So what specific skills then are currently in highest demand in this country?
So top two in the list, as it always is, this is the fifth edition of the survey, and I was just looking through the data over the last five editions, and number one, again, is engineering. 23% of respondents say that they find it most difficult to find engineering skills, and number two is ICT skills. I think ICT is no surprise with the world of AI and technology and how we're using it more and more. That skill is becoming more and more sought after and more scarce to find. And every year it's between those two that we compete for the top two spots. And then other skills that we also see on the list is artisans, foreign language speakers, especially with call centers that use foreign language skills, and then C-suite executives. We still see a high demand for C-suite executives, and I think especially as we see businesses expand globally, they look for those C-suite executives with global experience to be able to take their businesses into Africa and beyond.
Also interesting to see that healthcare professionals are important, science professionals, and media and marketing specialists. So for some of us, Marissa, I guess there's a bit of hope, yeah?
Absolutely, yeah. And I think it's important also to note that this survey is focused on South Africa, but if you look at the demand for skills globally, you can very easily, when you look at this list and you ask the UK, Australia, Europe, what are the skills that they find most difficult to recruit, you will see a similar list, and which makes it even more important for South Africa to really have an attractive offering and ease of bringing talent in because we're competing globally for these skills.
It's interesting when you look at engineering, for instance, and if you go back over the past five reports, it came in at 2018 at 14% and then steadily increased up to 23% in the 2023-24 report, which also tells me that we're not doing enough to attract skills like that in South Africa.
Yeah, absolutely. And I also think it goes both ways. I think we lose a lot of our engineering skills that go abroad. We see a lot of engineers in the UAE, a lot of engineers going through to Europe. So while we struggle to bring in, at the same time, we're losing our own local skills, which just increases that demand. And as you say, we've seen it going up and up year by year.
What challenges then do companies face when trying to attract skilled professionals into South Africa, and particularly in the space in which you operate? In other words, the documentation, the permission in order for a person to come into this country and work. Sometimes it's very difficult, isn't it?
Yes, it can be very difficult. And I think over the past few years, South Africa has had a particularly difficult time in terms of the Department of Home Affairs, a increasing backlog and increasing inconsistencies, making it very difficult for business to bring skills into the country and to collect the documentation and get visas processed. So it's been extremely difficult. I think in the past year, we've seen some improvement. We've seen the introduction of the Trusted Employer Scheme that's been extremely successful. And then, of course, with the appointment of the new minister, there's been a lot of positive sentiment around the ability to attract skills to South Africa, the improvements that we're hoping to see in the short term. And I think business is extremely positive about this. We had a conference yesterday where both Home Affairs and business spoke, and you could feel the sentiment in the room is definitely turning, where people are starting to feel hopeful and that there's really a new tide.
As far as bringing people into South Africa is concerned, you've referenced the Trusted Employer Scheme. You also have the whole issue about employment for families of critical skills work visa holders in South Africa. Both of those systems, now again talking to the point of streamlining, are based on a points system. Is that working optimally?
So the Trusted Employer Scheme is definitely, it's probably the best initiative that we've seen out of the Department of Home Affairs in the last 10, 15 years. It really looks to provide a streamlined process for large employers who are used to bringing skills in, who are familiar with Home Affairs processes. Of course, the Department of Home Affairs still signs off on the final visa being issued, but there's a streamlined and a smoother process for trusted employers. If we look at the ability for spouses to work in South Africa, that is something that still hasn't come through. We've seen the introduction of the remote work visa, which we are seeing businesses look to give that work ability to the spouses of talent that they're bringing in. But interestingly, it's the first time in the survey that we asked employers, do you find that your skilled talent that you bring in have a need for their spouses to also have work authorization? And 96% of business said yes, they believe that spouses should be granted automatic access to work. So I think that's powerful data that's coming from the South African business market.
Marissa Jacobs is the Managing Director of Expat Web. Thank you very much for joining me.
MoneyWeb at midday, for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, the much-vaunted Public Procurement Act is now law and intensifies preferential procurement requirements in state entities. But some state-owned companies could be in trouble unless they are exempted. I want to explore this now in a little more detail with Kelo Seleka, Senior Associate at the law firm Cliff Decker Hoffmeyer. He's in the dispute resolution department. Kelo, welcome. Thank you very much indeed. On the surface, this act seems positive, but I guess the devil is going to be in those exemptions.
Good afternoon, Jeremy. Thanks for having me. Well, when we look at it and we compare it with the current regulatory framework, there is not much of that difference. Some of the mechanisms that are being introduced were previously there. For example, the pre-qualification requirement, in the past, it used to be used before the 2017 PFMA unconstitutional. So the pre-qualification requirement is essentially whereby the procuring entity requires the bidders to either have a minimum BEE requirement or to subcontract certain portion of the work to historically disadvantaged individuals, which could be Black people, women, youth, or people living with disabilities. So essentially, some of the mechanisms were there before. So the act actually would reintroduce them.
Having said that, do you think there are specific exemptions that are necessary for SOEs to avoid procurement difficulties?
I honestly don't think so, because before the procurement entities issue a tender, they will do what we call a market analysis to determine whether the requirements that are stipulated in the bill are capable of being achieved. And the state has an obligation to promote socio-economic development landscape of the country. So it must use its resources to enhance participation of historically disadvantaged people.
One of the criticisms that's been raised is that SOE's ability to directly procure from OEMs, original equipment manufacturers, without the involvement of middlemen could be problematic.
Well, Jeremy, this is what I alluded to earlier. Before you make it mandatory, the state would have to do a market analysis, a due diligence, to satisfy itself that there is capacity in the country locally. And once that is confirmed, then it can be included as a bid condition. And doing that would not only promote local industries, but it also contributes to the creation of jobs.
But who has oversight around that market analysis? There have been concerns raised by the Chief Justice, anti-corruption groups, that around the prevention of corruption in public procurement. Do you believe that there are sufficient sufficient attention has been paid to this particular area, and that corruption within that middleman phase can be eradicated completely, or do you still have concerns in that respect?
Look, the Act also intends to create a public procurement officer, which would be mandated with the responsibility to ensure that there is compliance with the Act.
Is that not just another layer of bureaucracy that's going to complicate matters?
I don't think so. So now what it would assist with is that once you have lost a complaint, that officer is obligated to consider it, and they may also issue binding instructions. So once they've completed their investigation and they conclude that there's been non-compliance with the law, they can issue instructions that are binding to the procurement entity, which could be the withdrawal of the tender, of course.
And just one final issue, and I think it's associated to that office. Are there difficulties that could be experienced over this 30-day ministerial deliberation period?
Look, for the Act does now, Jeremy, is that it provides a skeleton. So it will be a framework that streamlines the public procurement process. The detail will be set out in the regulations. Before a procurement entity issues a tender, it has to do a due diligence and market analysis to make sure that the market will be able to comply. There's someone in the market that will be able to comply with the tender requirements.
All right. Thank you very much indeed. Kelo Seleka, Senior Associate in Dispute Resolution at the law firm Cliff Decker Hoffmeyer.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, there's no doubt that artificial intelligence is disrupting almost every industry and profession and is having a profound effect on the practice of law right now. Although AI is more likely to aid than replace attorneys in the near term, it's already being used to review contracts, find relevant documents in the discovery process, and obviously conduct legal research. So I want to take a look now at the advantages and the risks with Raphael Siegel, Director of Legal Interact. And Raphael, firstly then, what specific advantages, in your opinion, does AI offer in this process?
So AI is a real enablement. I mean, the way we see it, and we kind of put it into three areas. I think the first one is around productivity, but that's through automation, through driving efficiency, through taking cognitive load off people. I think the second one is around experience, around client experience. It really is an enabler to provide client experience in a materially different way than what we've been able to do in the past. And the third one, the way we think about it, is around content management and content generation. It's really good at doing that. And then I think the fourth pillar that we spent a lot of time on is how does AI enable us to think about generating revenue for our organization or our clients, or helping them stop leakage of revenue. So those are the four kind of quadrants we think about it in. It isn't just about one thing. We try to put it into one of those categories and then work backwards from there.
What's the take-up within the legal profession in South Africa like right now?
Jeremy, it's a mixed bag. I think there's a lot of interest. I think there's a lot of people who are watching it and are dipping their toes into it. I think there are people who are trying it. It's available. You can use ChatGPT. You can use other platforms. We see people taking it up. So when you talk about law firms, I think they're trying it out. I think they're very cautious. If you think about in-house legal teams, I think they have a different challenge. They've got to be more efficient. They've got to be more effective. They're working out how to use it. So that's interesting, because I think they're going to see that there's lots of opportunity to drive pricing improvements by working with these tools. So they're going to really focus and zone in on that. And then the consumer is fantastic. The South African consumer is using it, because, you know, I experienced launching my AI lawyer is we getting questions against my AI lawyer from the South African man in the street. And they're going to drive this because we're going to democratize access to justice for the South African public.
So you're painting a very positive picture, but you will agree with me that with the take-up of any new technology, there is always a caveat, and there are risks, surely, with the so-called embedded bias within AI data. And surely a bias like that could impact outcomes.
There definitely is, and I think one's got to be cautiously optimistic. To think that you could just let it be on autopilot would be a big mistake. But we need to understand the rules around transparency, fairness. The bias baked into the solution is definitely concerning. It's not always fine-tuned in a South African context or the African content context. That's always, we're getting Western-enabled models. But I think cautiously optimistic is the right way to go. And it is, we've talked about the Industrial Revolution. We've talked about the first, the second, the third. This is what's going to leapfrog us forward. You know, we can't tag along on this. We've actually got to get in front of this and be part of this process.
For most of us, our interaction with a law firm is going to come through contracts. There are potential dangers, surely, relying on AI-generated contracts without the so-called human oversight. Again, I guess you're going to say cautiously optimistic. We've got to be careful about that. But that observation is critical.
So you're spot on. And I think what's really interesting is always this anxiety about, you know, AI is going to get it so wrong and AI is going to get it wrong. And I do wonder, where is the research that says, you know, where have people got it wrong? So what makes us think that the human lawyer is that much better than the AI lawyer? I don't know. So where do we stand on that? Where are the stats to prove one's much better than the other? I do know this is that we're not going to live in a world where it's going to be robotic process automation. I think we are going to live in a world where it's human in the loop. I think there is no ways that you're just going to let this process flow all the way through. I think the idea is co-pilot. I think the idea is enablement for the human lawyer to be much more valuable without the load of having to perform every part of that draft, every part of that review, every part of identifying those risks. If the contract has been reviewed before, if we have a risk framework that we have identified and understand how to unpack, AI can do a really big part of that work in enabling the lawyer to evaluate whether the deviations are so significant. And it can explain why it's so significant and explain why the lawyer has to drop in and look at those sections, at those clauses. It's not so much black box stuff anymore. I know we all fear that it really is. There's a lot of noise around it. But when you talk about contracts, it's like if we're drafting first party papers, these are documents that we as lawyers would be drafting, then AI automation helps us with some of that process. If they're contracts to review because they're coming from third parties, then there's a lot that AI does. So AI can help us summarize them, that we can ground the AI to think like us, to actually say, approach it in this way. AI can help us get the term sheet out of it. AI can help us get the clauses out of it. AI can help us with the risk structure of the contract. We're seeing it. It's getting better all the time. I think that future is bright. Now, in South Africa, we might be at the starting points on this. Internationally, you know, this is happening. It's there.
I'm going to leave it there. Certainly a look at the future as far as the legal profession is concerned. Rafael Siegel, Director at Legal Interact, thank you very much for joining me today.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, here's an interesting pivot from the law to wasps, although some might say it's not a switch at all. But wasp invasions can have a devastating ecological impact. And I want to explore that in a little more detail now with Dr. Ruan Feldman, Senior Scientist, Biodiversity Research Assessment and Monitoring at the SA National Biodiversity Institute. He's written on the issue and joins me on the program now. And first of all then, Dr. Feldman, what is the impact of an invasion?
I think my largest issue is that it's sort of one of those things that it really hurts you when it happens, but until it does, no one sort of gives it attention. And the point is, these kinds of insects, they can have serious impacts, and South Africa thus far have been quite lucky in the two species that we have received haven't had major impacts. But the recent invasion in Europe is a very stark reminder of the potential impacts these type of organisms can have. And it's not like a plant where people aren't really threatened. It's an insect, it's large, it can cause hysteria, and it's an unpleasant organism.
In fact, you say that it has a real socioeconomic impact on a population that is affected. In what way? Could you explain that to me?
So let's say the party probably most affected would be beekeepers. So if you're talking about the Asian hornet, Africa doesn't have hornets that are native. So our species aren't used to this type of insect. And because it's so large and it's in itself social, so it wants large, dependable food resources, the predator. So a honeybee colony is basically like a McDonald's, and they can get a steady food supply from there. And because honeybees are so important in agriculture and also in our environment, there is potential for very, very large impacts.
Could you explain to me, Dr. Feldman, how these invasive wasp species typically spread to new areas? What factors would contribute to their movement?
So largely these we call them jump dispersals. There is a element of chance in it, almost like playing the lotto. And it's as a stowaway. So it's something being shipped to South Africa, and then the wasp is there, and you only need one mated queen. If she's then being stowed away, and if that queen then lands in a suitable place in the new country and can build a nest, then basically you can start the invasion.
What's the status as far as invasion is concerned in South Africa? I understand there could be a problem in the Western Cape.
So just to avoid confusion, so we have the German wasp and the European paper wasp.
Right.
And that's the only two social wasp species that are currently invasive in South Africa. And the one in the article I raised much bigger concerns is the Asian hornet, which is not in South Africa at all. It's not in Africa. So its native range is China, Eastern Asia, and it's now invaded Europe. In France, it started 2004, but now it basically occurs in the whole Western Europe. And also concerning, there's been a few incidences in the U.S. on the East Coast, in Georgia, and the Americans were very quick to respond, and they actually exterminated that population. But essentially, as long as people are trading and sending goods all over the world, we will have a threat of these unwanted insects being transported to our country.
So explain to me then the difficulties associated with controlling or eradicating these invasive wasp populations. How difficult is it to bring the situation under control?
It's one of those things that if you do something early on, it's easier to get the desired effect, and it would cost far less than leaving it and waiting till it reaches epic proportions. So that's essentially it's money-wise to stop invasions from happening, and then there's different stages. If you can't do that and they establish, then you must try and eradicate those established populations, and if you manage that, then you prevent them from spreading further. But in all cases, by not doing anything, you're basically taking a chance and then seeing what the end impact would be. And when a species, let's say the species is widely occurring in South Africa, we wouldn't be able to do anything about it.
Do you believe that we have sufficient planning in this country associated with that threat, or do we need a wake-up call?
So I work for the South African National Biodiversity Institute, and it's our job in the invasive species group to actually monitor for threats, so biological organisms that are threats. I'm an entomologist there, so I'm very concerned with the insects. And then we work with the Department of Forestry, Fisheries and the Environment, and we give advice on what should be done. So definitely anything that is not in the country yet but does arrive would immediately get a response from our institute.
You make the point that citizen scientists have a role in contributing to monitoring and managing invasive wasp populations. Explain that to me.
Jeremy, I can't stress this enough. It's such a useful tool and a resource scientists can use, because essentially you're turning any person into someone who can gather some scientific record. And if you then pull that across a whole bunch of people or a whole country, even across the globe, you have so much data coming in that the number of eyes looking for these things are far more than even if we had a full set of government inspectors. And usually with these wasps, you get like one or two seasons that you have to detect them and kill those very few number of nests. But after that, and they start to reproduce, and maybe we're looking at 50 or more nests, then you start losing the chance to eradicate them.
I'm going to leave it there, and thank you very much indeed, Dr. Ruan Veldtmann from the South African National Biodiversity Institute. I do appreciate your time today. Thank you. And that brings our program to a close for this Thursday. Just before I say goodbye and leave you, today on our online poll, and it references an interview we had a little earlier, the use of artificial intelligence in law. And I'm wondering if you think it's helpful, if you think there is a worrying factor as far as this is concerned, or if the entire concept needs more study. So the use of AI in law, helpful, worrying, or needs more study. If you have a view on that and would like to participate in the poll, I invite you to go to either our X or LinkedIn page. That's also our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We are then up as a podcast. Goodbye to you, and thank you for listening.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.